change the world together. Welcome to the Snapcast, the podcast for all nonprofit professionals, bringing you interviews and amazing ideas for nonprofit leaders.
Hello, my friends. This is the Nonprofit Snapcast. Thank you for joining us. This is Mickey Desai, or rather, I am Mickey Desai. I don't know if there's a grammatically preferred way to say that sentence. And my guest for today is Jack Silverstein. Jack, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you, Mickey.
You're in Ottawa?
Ottawa, the nation's capital.
Right. So first of all, my obvious stupid question for the day is, what's the weather like up there today?
It snowed yesterday, so we probably got about 4 inches or about 15 centimeters yesterday. It's a little cold. It's around the freezing mark.
Sure. If that happened here in Atlanta, the whole city would be just at a dead standstill.
Yes, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I'm sure.
So I know we're going to talk nonprofits, and I occasionally get the question as to how the nonprofit world in Canada legally differs from the nonprofit world in the States. Do you have the answer to that question or any idea what those differences might be?
Yeah, there's actually a bunch of differences. The first is in the States, donations are tax deductible, where in Canada, they're tax receivable. So in the States, you deduct it right off of your income. And in Canada, it goes towards tax credits, which helps alleviate your tax obligation, but it does not go against a deduction against income.
So
that's probably the biggest.
Yeah.
As well as receding. So in the States, you guys can write a check for $1,000 and that counts as your receipt for when you file your taxes. In Canada, you need an official charitable receipt.
I see. I don't know. Somehow that seems preferable to me in some ways, but I'm not a legislator, so what do I know?
Exactly. I'm sure there's rules and reasons for it from each side. But I know that in Canada, people are very stringent as to what constitutes a charitable gift and what does not constitute a charitable gift.
I see. So you sent me a number of topics here that I hope we have. We may actually do multiple episodes if we have time to do that at some point.
Perfect.
But first of all, please introduce yourself to our audience. And if you have no preference, I think I know which one of these things I would like to tackle first, but I'll defer to you on this matter. So please tell us a little bit more about yourself.
So my name is Jack Silverstein, and I've been in fundraising for a little over 25 years. And I'm one of the few people that actually have been in fundraising my whole life, as opposed to people who have fallen into it or did it off the side of their desk and just kind of assumed it over the years. I grew up in a high school where the Cancer Society door-to-door canvas was entrusted to the high school students, and it was a great way to get out of class. So I certainly didn't do it for altruistic reasons, but I was so fascinated as to some of the folks that would give just very meaningful gifts. You know, you're going back probably 30 some odd years ago. And, you know, when you get a crisp $100 bill, that was big money in those days.
Sure.
So I wound up staying with Cancer Society, and I volunteered as a on their board all throughout my college years. And then the local executive director of the Cancer Society had a friend of his that was starting a fundraising consulting business. So I did that for a while. A good Jewish boy, my specialty was Catholic churches.
That's brilliant.
Yeah. And then I moved to... I moved to the nation's capital here in Ottawa, and since then I've done work at the universities, at the hospitals, at the Jewish federations, the Jewish community foundations, and most recently at the YMCA.
I see. Wow. Okay. Very cool.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you could be my partner on today's episode.
Well, thank you.
Among the topics that you sent, is there any one of these that you'd like to talk about first?
No, I can let you. I'm well versed in all of them, so I'll let you.
The one that stands out, the ones that stands out to me the most is the inevitable amalgamation of some charities precipitated by COVID-19. What if our charity disappeared tonight? That's something that's definitely worth talking about. So, how do we start that conversation? What happens if my charity did disappear tonight?
That's a great question. And when I originally tackled this issue, I did it pre-COVID. Mm-hmm. I'm a strong advocate. In Canada, there's about 88,000 charities. In the States, it's obviously hundreds of thousands of charities. And the governing body, Canadian Revenue Agency, that issues the charitable numbers, don't necessarily look at the question, is this charity needed? They just look to see if, you know, all the I's are dotted and T's are crossed, and if your objects are charitable in nature. But, you know, if you have a loved one that passes away from cancer and you wanted to make a meaningful donation, in Ottawa, there's no less than about 35 different worthy charities that you could donate to further the cause. And, you know, the reality is that everyone is kind of a splinter group. And at some point, they were all under one umbrella and someone got ticked off at the direction that fundraising was going or governance was going and says, OK, I'm taking my baseball and bat and I'm going to go down the street and open up my own shop. Right. And it really doesn't put the donor first at all. It's totally about, you know, hey, this is our agenda and hopefully we'll get enough people to kind of sign on to our agenda. It makes it very confusing for the donors because all they want to do is eradicate cancer, right? They don't necessarily know the nuances in between the 12 different prostate cancer charities that are there. But, you know, so I think that what's happening now is you're seeing that a lot of charities are seeing a huge decrease in their revenues. Though there was just a study that was published in the last couple of weeks by the Fundraising Effectiveness Project through AFP that actually dispels that myth and says that no, fundraising is actually up. The places where fundraising, I believe, is down or taking a bit of a hit are the places that are exceptionally reliant on events and other ones that are doing campaigns, like big capital campaigns. So the capital campaigns are on pause for the most part because people haven't quite figured out how they're going to rejig things. And as we all know, events are pretty much dead from the traditional standpoint of an event. A lot of charities have been nimble enough to kind of pivot and to have virtual events, which are quite successful. But really kind of taking a look and seeing that those that rely heavily on events are going to have to reimagine themselves. And this might be a great time for some of these charities to amalgamate from a position of strength before it gets down the path where they have to amalgamate because they're ready to go belly up. So I think that really kind of combining and having more charities that work together, even as funders, they love to see kind of cooperation between the charities. Rather than duplication of efforts. So I think that there's going to be a lot of things coming out of COVID that are really going to kind of put our industry on its ear.
Right. And I've heard that, you know, elsewhere as well, that events are hurting, but out of COVID has become sort of a renewed opportunity to strengthen one-on-one stewardship of donors. And
Yeah. You know, I have a good friend of mine, Jason Lewis, who wrote the War for Fundraising Talent. And he talks about, you know, transactional or arm's length fundraising. And I think the days of arm's length fundraising are done and COVID has really just kind of put it into great limelight. So, you know, the direct mails are out there, but it's really making sure there's that stewardship and fostering some deep relationships. That's going to be the future of fundraising. It's not going to be the one and done kind of events where sometimes if they're sponsoring you for a bike-a-thon, they don't care so much about the organization that you're riding a bike for. They're doing it to help you.
Right.
And to support you.
Right. And, you know, I don't know if you would agree, and this may be an unpopular opinion on my part, but there's part of me that thinks, okay, this is terrible that we're in this situation. On the other hand, it has always been my advice to nonprofits to spend more attention to their, you know, individual donor game and not take the risks associated with doing just event-based fundraising. And so pandemic has sort of inadvertently pushed us in a slightly healthier direction in that regard.
Yeah, I would agree. You know, events are a costly way to raise money. I actually worked with one organization that was smart enough to actually move all the events under the marketing auspices and take it away from the fundraising department because they said it's really friend-raising. It's not fundraising.
Right.
And they have a different set of goals. You know, they would rather have 1,000 people in the room and earn 50,000 people than have, you know, 25 people in the room and get $100,000.
Exactly.
Right. So it's a different mentality as well. Boards and bosses, events are easy to replicate. And there's a whole kind of formula for events. And you know what differentiates a good event from a bad event. And you know where your levels need to be. When it comes to major gift philanthropy, there's no kind of standards for that. You know, a major gift could take, you know, 2-3 years to actually go from cultivation to getting that gift.
Right.
And, you know, it's, so it's hard for boards and bosses to kind of evaluate those as to whether they're working or not. So in the interim, they want something really easy, replicable, and something that they could report on.
Right.
And it's a little bit different when it comes to the major gift world.
Right. So events give people that instant gratification sense, and
totally.
Major gifts, you have to learn how to delay. Delay the gratification. Right.
Yeah. And, you know, events also, I'm one of the few people that I know of that always insist on, when I did events, on reporting the net number.
Yes.
And most people don't. They have a gross number, and it's misleading. You know, we had an event years ago, and they brought in Bill Clinton to come and speak. It was right after Hillary first won her seat in the Senate. So the day after that.
Wow.
So it was jam packed. It was like $10,000 a head. And I know the chairman for the event, you know, the event, as he told me, it raised $1.4 million. And I'm like, no, it might have grossed $1.4 million. Right. And when they wound up to coming up with the net was under $400,000. And his group gave 250 of that.
Oh, my goodness.
I said, wow, that's spooky. And I said, that also doesn't account for any time.
Right.
Right. I double net things. So I take a look and then say, okay, how many staff did it take to do this? Right. And did it take, you know, one person 6 months of their salary to do that, which isn't unrealistic. You knock that off. And then all of a sudden, it's not a moneymaker.
Right. 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 No, the bang for the buck is always better on individual asks than it is for event-based fundraising.
Most definitely.
Yeah.
Most definitely.
So when you say the inevitable amalgamation of some charities precipitated by COVID-19,
yeah.
How do we steer towards that? What does that mean exactly?
So I think that a lot of charities are struggling. And it's, you know, in Canada, the vast majority of charities have a handful of staff or less. They're small shops. You know, it's not the Harvards or, you know, big hospitals. They're tiny little shops for the most part. And they don't have the wherewithal to kind of weather the storm. Some of the bigger charities have reserves on hand, whether it's endowment or whether they actually make a conscious effort to put reserves aside. And some of the smaller charities do not, because they're just so hand to mouth and they're so lean that there's really no wiggle room. Well, I think with COVID, you know, it's put that undue stress on them, and it's really kind of exposed their lack of forward thinking, right? To not set aside some money for a rainy day. So I think that some of them really have to re-examine. I think they have to re-examine how they're going to actually deliver their product. So if you think about, you know, people in the housing business, having communal kitchens and communal bathrooms are probably not going to be on the recipe on a go forward basis. You're going to have to be able to, you know, if there's isolation, you're going to have to be able to have everyone have their own self-contained unit.
Right.
So it's kind of looking at things differently, and to be able to be, you know, big boys and big girls enough to say, you know what, there's someone out there who's doing it better than us, and that's good. And maybe it's time that we just kind of hang our hat up and either join them or just, you know, gracefully bow out.
Right. Right. And there's actually nothing wrong with making those decisions from a strategic place of power. Like you said, it's better to make those decisions proactively than reactively.
100%. But I found that so many places, the people who are making the decisions are in it. And, you know, they take a look and they said, well, if we fold up, then I'm out of a job.
Yeah.
So they would never do that. And it's not what's best for the organization. It's what's best for, you know, Jane Doe.
Right.
And that's a horrible shame.
It's a terrible shame. And part of me in my devil's advocate position here is when this thing happens, it's not necessarily a staff decision though. It's, you know, it's right. A board decision to do that. The staff may simply get caught in the wash.
Yeah. Yeah. I would agree. But many boards are, you know, kind of take the direction from the staff. The staff are the ones that are there day in, day out.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
You know, so a lot of times they defer to the staff, rightfully or wrongfully, they defer to the staff. It's just, those are the people on the ground. Those are the people who really, you know, are seeing things from the bird's eye view.
Right. Right. And yeah, I mean, I'm trying, I know I sound callous in these things that I say, and I'm really not a callous individual, but, you know, for the sake of discussion though, if we are trying to preserve, the good works of an entity, sometimes you have to let the chips fall where they may.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with that. You know, there was a great, you know, I watched 60 Minutes. I feel like I'm some senior citizen, but I watched 60 Minutes religiously. And I believe there was the guy who was one of the founders of Home Depot set up a fund for New York University's School of Medicine. And they essentially paid for all of the medical students' tuition.
Wow.
100%, whether you needed it or not, they paid for it. Wouldn't it be great to kind of say, have a big banner saying mission accomplished?
Yes.
Right? Like, there's no polio charity out there anymore because we've eradicated it in the first world.
Right.
So wouldn't it be great? You know, an ideal dream would be all these charities wouldn't need to exist because we've solved all of society's problems.
Right. But I mean, again, at some level, I think that's every nonprofit professional's dream come true to realize that you've actually successfully worked yourself out of a job.
Right.
As much of a headache as it is to find the next job, I think that's still all of us idealists. I think that's our dream come true.
Most definitely. Most definitely. But in, you know, in the day of COVID where, you know, unemployment is at a record level, you know, that it hasn't been at in decades, people are a little bit worried and they're like, you know what, I'll come in and kind of hang my hat and do my stuff because I have a job and I'm happy to have a job. And, you know, I could be cut at any time.
Right. So I'm going to ask you if you can think of any examples where you've seen these machinations occur. Have you seen amalgamations and mergers take place?
I have, and I see regionalization coming down the pike. So a lot of the national charities, you know, Cancer Society is one of them. You know, they used to have community hubs in basically every big community, and they've disbanded that, and they disbanded that early in the spring, and just said they can't keep up that level. So it's all kind of done at the 20,000 foot level from the corporate office, and they'll send people as needed. But it's really kind of the big national organizations that are regionalizing. And that's where everything is going these days. You know, in a world economy, everyone is regionalizing, whether you're a bank or whether you're a telecom company, everyone is regionalizing.
Right. No, that's true. So I'm sure there's a little bit more about this to unpack. If there's parting words of wisdom to a nonprofit leader on the topic of doing these mergers, these combinings, you know, partnering on, even if it's just something simple as partnering on mission objectives,
what
would you tell those leaders?
Well, I think it's really time to re-examine a SWOT analysis, you know, your strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. And are those still true? You know, every organization comes up with a SWOT analysis when they do their strategic planning every 5 years or so. And do those still hold true today? And, you know, with COVID, what has happened to your organization? How has it been able to kind of weather the tides there? So, you know, you look at in Canada, we went through some pretty tight shutdowns. So, you know, the social service agencies became the darlings of the media, right? You know, the food banks and things of that sort, because people are really taking a look during COVID and saying, wow, you know, but for the grace of God, go thee, right? You know, I certainly could have been in line for food stamps or something. The arts have been totally decimated in Canada because they're closed to the public.
You can't
go to a symphony. You can't go to a museum. You know, there's limits as to the number of people that are even allowed inside a building at the same time. So, you know, all these things that people really want. And I think having a Zoom concert, while it's a nice fad, I don't think that it's really going to drive home the need for having a world-class symphony in your area.
Right. Jack, there's more to talk about, but I wanted to say that you've got or at least remark that you've got a book coming out, or is it already out, or is it about to come out?
It's available for pre-order, but it comes out in 1 week, December 1. It's called Tales from the Trenches, What I Learned from 25 Years in Fundraising. So it's, you know, a bunch of anecdotes from, you know, myths about fundraising to donors, prospects, major gifts. But I really take a look at it and re-examine some of my original thoughts through a COVID lens as well. Do those assumptions still hold true? Are they not true? I'm a strong advocate of donor relationships. So I think that COVID has really cemented the fact that you really need to have some deep and meaningful donor relationships. If everyone is arm's length, they're going to disappear in 12 seconds.
Right. Jack, this is good stuff. I hope we can circle around and do another episode if you have time today. In the meantime, if a listener has questions for you or wanted to find your book or drop you a line, how would you suggest they find you?
They can find my book on Amazon. It's available for Kindle pre-order now, but the book will be out next week. Or they can go to www.yucks.ca.
Fantastic. Jack Silverstein, thank you for taking the time to do this episode with me today.
Thanks, Mickey.
This has been The Snapcast. Thank you for joining us.